The Afterbeat podcast is always available on the Afterbeat Pod website, www.afterbeatpod.com. That is a Squarespace site. Squarespace is the place for great websites, great tools, great hosting, great people, great customer service. We love them. And hey, Squarespace, throw us a few bucks, sponsor us. Anyway, also on the iTunes Store, on our page on the iTunes Store, where, by the way, we are always free, even though it's a store. Podcasts are free, and we are there. Today's episode features Dr. Tom Mason in a special discussion, two-part discussion, our first two-part episode, about jazz education. Tom is a great sax player and composer, arranger, all-around jazz genius, and this is an interesting discussion we had about jazz education. Tom is the founding chairman of the USC Thornton School of Jazz, and I don't think it's called that, but that's what it is. And for a long time was the chairman there. Now he is a professor in the jazz studies department there, and he does a great job. And we're talking about jazz ed. So it's two parts. Open up something cool, kick back, and listen. Here's part one. It's the Afterbeat Podcast.
When you were a kid and all that odd meter shit was happening, did you ever, like, just deliberately practice weird ways of counting seven and...
No, because I was trying to hang on just to counting like a 4+3 or a 3+4, just doing what was in front of me. And the thing about, like, oh, what if it's a 2-2-2-1-7 or something? That didn't come around until years later. But you got to remember, I had... all these odd time guys, Don Ellis and John Magruder and all that, I mean, they were like childhood friends of mine and buddies. That's actually for you.
Oh, thank you.
And influences on me. So I learned the whole time thing like really early.
Oh, I guess
artificially early, yeah. I met John Magruder when I was 14, and he was playing in Don Ellis's band.
Yes, he was the baritone player.
He was a baritone guy and had written some of those charts. And one of the advantages of that, besides the fact that I got married at his house... One of the advantages of knowing John early on was that he treated everything as it was the same. It was all just music to him. So whether it was in 125/4 or 4/4 was not, there was no distinction there.
That's right. You
know? Which was kind of cool. Kind of cool. Kind of odd at the
Very
time.
Very smart.
Yeah. He was a smart guy that way. He was a smart guy in a lot of ways.
Well, see, I didn't get the Magruder side because being a sax player, he probably already had everybody pretty much sorted out as to who he was going to have in his band by the time I showed up in L.A. But on the other side of it, I became friends quite early with Milcho Leviev.
Oh, yeah. Who was part of that band.
Yes.
Part of that circle.
And, of course, Milcho's, Bulgarian Bulge, yeah. I think, was one of his tunes and several other things. And he used to, like, we'd play like a blues in 5/4, and then he would take me over to the side and say, "Now, this is why it's not working."
Right, right. He understood that.
Oh yeah.
So the guy I'm talking to, who talked to Milcho, you're talking about back in the '60s or '70s. Yeah, you got here in the '70s, right?
I got here in 1977.
Dr. Tom Mason got here in 1977, and boy, that's probably I probably met you fairly soon after that on some nameless gig somewhere.
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah. Probably playing for a wedding somewhere.
A wedding or a fashion show. There used to be gigs in those days. We would play gigs, and that was cool. So Dr. Tom Mason came out here. Did you come out here to do the USC program, or was that just something that happened at the same time, or what got you out here?
Well, it's an interesting story. I had been brought to Dallas, Texas to be composer in residence for a project called the Contemporary Music Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I had come there in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And while I was there, I think the most important thing that happened to me was I helped co-found the Dallas Jazz Orchestra, which foreshadowed a number. Today there are all kinds of bands, like the band, for example, that you and I play in,
right,
which are kicks bands that do a reasonable number of paying gigs in the course of the year, but we basically play in the bands because we have good friends. It's a camaraderie,
right?
You know. So anyway, the Dallas Jazz Orchestra was a wonderful thing for me. In 1976, I did a tour of the West Coast doing contemporary music pieces. I'm a trained classical composer,
mm-hmm.
And I did a concert at USC, and the dean came up to me and he said, "You're just the man I'm looking for." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I want you to start a jazz department at USC." He says, "I can't have a jazz person come in here and do it because the faculty is too resistant mm-hmm. to that. But you have the credentials. So would you be interested?" And I think it took about a zillionth of a second. Are you kidding? Start your own department?
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order.
So I said, absolutely, yeah. You know. And so I took a leave from Southern Methodist, which is where I was located mm-hmm. as composer in residence in Dallas, and came out here. And in 1981, 4 years later, we had a full-blown jazz department. We had a master's degree, and we were on our way to having a doctoral program. Mm-hmm. And it's, as we say, straight ahead and strive for tone.
Yeah, and now it's one of the, I think it's one of the important jazz programs in the country, in the world, perhaps.
We're recognized as being among one of the top 10, I would say. Mm-hmm. Where are we? Well, we're certainly not number one. I'm not sure who that would be. It depends on some people would say it's the Berklee College, which I did go to. Mm-hmm. But others would say, oh, no, it's Juilliard, or it's...
Well, and possibly there's no one answer to that. Maybe it depends. Certainly in volume mm-hmm. of people graduated, it's probably Berklee, because everybody comes out of Berklee with a music degree of some kind.
That's true.
And that's all they do there. So there's that. But where... the hook for this episode is jazz education. That's what I want to talk to you about. But okay. But to get there, I want to talk about your background as well, because you're a great player. I mean, I always admire hearing you and playing with you and all of that.
Well, likewise.
And thank you. And I don't want that to get lost. I mean, the reason that the dean heard something in you and the reason that you've gotten to where you've gotten is because you can play your horn and you understand music and all that. So that's mm-hmm. People get into academia and sometimes that gets lost. And I don't want that to get lost. So what's your background? Where did you begin?
Grew up in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. I have a fascinating tale to tell. My senior year in high school, I was playing with a band in Milwaukee, a big dance band. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of rock and rollers came into Milwaukee to do a warm-up.
What year is this?
1959.
Okay.
January. And the leader of one of the bands was a guitar player with big glasses, Buddy Holly. Mm-hmm. And I was warming up backstage, and I get this tap on my shoulder, and I said, "Yeah." He says, "Say, do you know Tequila?" I said, "Yeah." And I started to play a little bit. He says, "Great." He says, "Richie Valens is going to be doing some tunes, and then we want to do a couple of warm-up tunes, and we'd like to do Tequila. You want to play?" I said, "Sure." Well, after the concert, which basically we were playing the dance band and they were warming up before they were going to go to Chicago,
right.
Buddy's manager comes back and says, "Buddy wants you to join the band." Mm. I'm going, "Really?"
How old were you?
I was a senior in high school, so I must have...
Oh, okay, so you're like 17 or 18, mm-hmm. yeah.
So I had to get permission, because in Wisconsin you couldn't miss more than a certain number of days. Mm-hmm. And that permission is part of the reason why I'm here. And some of the guys aren't. Because the deal we worked out was the tour never did concerts on Mondays. And so the day before Buddy and Richie and the Big Bopper were killed was a Sunday. They were killed on a Monday. Mm-hmm. So what happened was the deal that I had was I would, wherever we were, I would fly or take a bus or a cab or something to an airport, fly into what at the time was Midway Airport rather than O'Hare, because there was no O'Hare.
Yeah.
Then I would take a train to Milwaukee. Then I would go to school and sleep all day through class because that, but I was there.
Yeah.
You know, as long as I went in school on Monday.
Sorry.
As long as that, I was cool. So I slept all day Monday. And when it was all over, I come home. And my mom's crying, and she meets me at the door, and I go, well, what's going on? Is something, did Dad get hurt? Is my sister sick? What's the matter? Yeah. She says, no, they're dead. And I'm going, who are you talking, a buddy? And she says, yeah.
Wow.
So I called up the manager, said, what's going to happen? He says, well, we're going to have Frankie Avalon, and we're going to have Fabian Forte, and we're going to have Dion the Belmonts, and they're going to finish out the tour. But that was the beginning of my career. It was hardly hardly jazz, but I went on from there, went to Chicago, played a lot in Chicago, went to school, played the Playboy Club, which was a great gig because there was this deal where the bunnies were not allowed to date cardholders.
Right.
So the musicians were about the only available males that they could date.
You were the pool, eh?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I remember playing the Playboy Clubs. Yeah. That was fun. So, but before that, what got you into the saxophone? I mean, how did that start?
How did that start?
Your parents musical?
No.
Yeah.
Not really. I had dreams, fantasies of playing the saxophone in my dreams when I was a very young child. Mm-hmm. And when I finally got to play the saxophone, it was to play in a church band. And the problem with it was they were playing all these hymns, and I couldn't really read the music, but I knew the hymns because I had been going to those churches as a kid. So I guess I went through the process that a lot of jazz musicians go through, playing by ear.
Yeah.
And loved it. And then eventually when we moved to Milwaukee, by that time I had learned to... I was in Pennsylvania then, so when I got to Milwaukee, I learned how to read and eventually got a bachelor's degree in music and was going to be a music teacher and moved to Chicago to teach at a Catholic high school for girls.
Okay.
Let me tell you, that was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
How long were you there?
Now, don't take it the wrong way.
I won't. Oh,
please.
I won't.
Okay. But what happened was there were only two male teachers in the whole school, and the other guy was a paraplegic. Mm. And the sister who ran the school was named Sister John Marie, and I wasn't Catholic, so I called her John, which really annoyed.
Yeah, it must have got under her skin.
No, she thought it was funny. But
oh, really?
The other nuns were, I was being totally disrespectful.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And whenever she would call me, I would have to go into the school after classes were over. And the thing is, the girls would be changing clothes in front of their lockers to go work in the 7-Eleven, well, if there was one, something like that. And so there would be this scream, which would precede me down the hall.
So everyone knew when you were coming.
Yeah. By the time I got to Sister John's office, I'd walk in. She says, well, I heard you coming for the last 5 minutes.
That's funny.
But being that I was at the Catholic school, I could get off of school early to take classes at DePaul University because DePaul is a Catholic school and they had this deal worked out. So that's where I got my master's. And then
so is that in composition or performance?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, and I was playing all over town.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just Chicago was a madhouse.
Yeah, there was a lot of work then. I know there was a lot of jingles and there were live dates and all kinds of stuff.
I think I may have done the last Marlboro commercial.
Wow.
Because, you know, there came a point where you couldn't do commercials on
the radio,
newspaper.
TV, yeah.
I mean, on
media.
You couldn't do cigarette commercials.
Yeah.
And they were being done in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. Chicago was... Chicago was where all the jingles were done for a long, long time. Because Chicago was a radio center originally.
Yes.
And so that was the evolution of that.
It was fascinating.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
So then you leave Chicago to take a better gig or
go to teach in Eastern Michigan University, which is just outside Detroit. Okay.
Did you play in Detroit at all?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I played on several Motown dates.
Oh, cool.
And... there was a guy named Johnny Trudell, and he was the contractor. Mm-hmm. And I played with the Austin Morrow Big Band, which was, again, sort of a kicks band that was popular at the time.
Yep.
Then I got a chance to go to New York, went to Queens College and taught there for about a year, and really just never connected mentally with New York. Mm-hmm. I felt I wasn't going to make enough money to be able to raise a family and do stuff. So then when the position came up to be composer in residence in Dallas, I said, I'll take it.
And at this point, are you already married and have a family?
Now, by the time I get to New York, yes.
Yeah.
I got married right around the time I got to Eastern Michigan University. Mm-hmm. And that was quite an amazing period in my life. We had our version of the jazz rock band called Helmet Pisters. Jazz rock band.
It actually was called a jazz rock band.
Yes,
so that nobody would make a mistake over what it was, right?
Well, it was a rock rhythm section with horns.
Right, yeah.
And we had our our funk soul bluesy pop singer, mm-hmm. you know, the our version of Dave and Clayton Thomas, yeah. you know, that kind yeah. of thing. And it was a wonderful time in my life. I got to play with, you know, a good couple of wonderful big bands. Mm-hmm. I played with one band. I was like the only white guy on the band, and we would rehearse in the black section of Chicago, and there would always be a security guard watching the cars because it was a rough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And one night I locked my keys in the car and I walk up to the guard and I say, what am I going to do? I got to go home. And the guard says, walk around the block. So I walked around the block. When I come back, the trunk is open, the hood is up, all four doors are open, and the lights are on. And my keys are in the ignition.
Right.
And I just walked up and he says, don't ask.
Yeah, yeah. He had no problem getting into that car. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. So so you've always taught. You've always taught at a high level, it sounds like to me.
Well, once I got my degrees, yeah, yeah. Because I wanted the... I think I'm good at conveying information.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to research things and then share what I've discovered with other people.
Well, and you're well organized, and you have the things that a teacher needs to have. You're a natural teacher.
I hope so.
That's what I think, yeah.
I hope so.
So, but it's different because a lot of people, they play for a while, they write for a while, they either get bored with it or they need more money or they need something steady or, you know, whatever, check off one of those boxes, and they fall into teaching and they discover that they like it and they stay there. But you, like, started, it sounds to me anyway, like you kind of started out teaching at the beginning of your real professional career and you stuck with it, although you've also had a career as a player, a parallel career as a player, which is not easy to do.
Yeah, I think all of it came to a screaming end when I came on the faculty at USC because the dean said, now, you got to understand that if you have a choice between a recording session and a class, you don't have a choice. And I had to really look at that
mm-hmm.
because part of why I had moved to LA was I wanted to play with the guys whose names were on all of
right.
all the tracks that I owned and liked. I mean, I wanted to play with these guys.
Sure.
And now I was playing with them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's saying, you can't do that. Now, there have been three or four deans, and that whole policy has changed.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, because that's been with some discussion around town about that, that has changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, the other thing he said is, at the time I was teaching at the Guitar Institute of Technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about everywhere, you know.
Yeah, I was there too in the early days. So
okay.
Yeah.
I taught there, and I taught at the Dick Grove Music School,
mm-hmm.
and I had been invited to do some teaching at Pepperdine. And of all those schools, the one that the dean at USC was most concerned about was Pepperdine because it was a four-year academic
right.
institution.
The others were more or less trade schools, yeah.
Yeah, he had no problem with me being a GIT, mm-hmm. so... And it was kind of funny, fun. It was really neat.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, that brings up one of the points I wanted to discuss. And we can jump around. We don't have to be chronological here.
Okay.
But I've heard from other people, from students and from teachers there at USC, that there has been a problem with people taking off to do too many gigs. Some people in particular, other people are cool with it. Some people find that a controversial, you know, thing to do. But I've always contended that if you're going to teach this thing that we do, you have to be actually doing it or you have kind of nothing to teach. You either get stuck in one period and you remain competent at teaching that, but the world moves on, or else you kind of just lose touch and then you really don't have anything to teach. I think it's important to go in and out of that. I don't know that that's possible. And of course, I'm not the administrator of a program, so I don't know the headaches of trying to deal with that on a practical basis. But talk to me about that. I mean, that's my opinion, is that... is there any validity there, or am I just full of it?
Well, when I created the department, I was chair for 18 consecutive years.
Yeah.
Therefore, I had to face this
right.
fairly quickly.
Probably a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and what I found was if you got a really qualified substitute, and by this I had to explain to some of my faculty members Qualified means that in your mind, whether you want to admit it or not, you honestly think they're as good or better than you are.
Right, which is what you do when you're on a gig, too. If you can't make it, you need to send a good sub, not just someone to fill the chair.
That's right. Yeah. You don't want a placeholder, is right. what my wife calls
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you don't want that.
Yeah.
And when there are complaints, usually it has to do with the fact that the faculty member in question is sending in someone who is not at the same standard that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the students and their parents have a right to be angry when they're paying a lot of money and they're not getting a star.
Yeah.
If I were teaching saxophone, I don't now.
Right.
But at the time, I would have gotten Bob Shepard
mm-hmm.
to sub for me.
Yeah.
I would have gotten... Gary Herbig.
Right.
I would have gotten one of the heavy-duty saxophone players of the city to sub for me. I think Bob Mentzer, I don't know how he deals with the issue of saxophone, but I know that he, first of all, Bob Shepard now teaches for
right.
us, so we've got that kind of backup.
Yeah.
To me, that's ethical. And then you should really be paying these guys out of your pocket enough that it hurts a little.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm not always sure that the guys do that.
Well, that's a personal decision everyone's got to make. But what concerns me is the institutions that have this policy of once you're here, you have to be here and you have to commit 100%. And then you have people who become sort of mired in academia,
mm-hmm.
never get out, never play a record date or do a tour or even do a casual or something, just to keep their hand in, at least, to know what's going on,
You have to do that.
I think you do, yeah. And I think the institutions have to realize that.
Yeah, I'm...
There's a bottle of water behind you, by the way, if you find
Oh, well, thank you.
Need.
But for me, now, the fact that you're a guitar player... In fact, we ought to do this sometime. My all-time favorite group to play with is modeled after the Jimmy Giuffre Three.
Mm-hmm.
Which had Ralph Pina on bass
right.
and Jimmy Hall on guitar.
Yeah.
So is Giuffre playing all of his toys, Hall and bass. No
right.
drums.
Yep.
Guitar players, by definition, typically play no more than four notes at a time, occasionally five, rarely six.
Mm, not unless you have to.
Well, if you figured out some kind of hip voicing, you'll use it maybe at the end of a phrase, but you're not strumming the damn thing.
Yeah. Do as little of that as possible.
Exactly.
Or at least I do.
Yeah. Well, for me, that's that the clarity, the transparency
mm-hmm.
of that kind of group. At this point, I've been telling my wife, I really want to put a band like that back together. It's not about making money. It's about I just want to play in that kind of environment.
Yeah,
again.
Just that sound, yeah.
Yeah, I've always loved that.
It's very clean, very sparse.
Yeah, and I'm a good clarinet player, so I enjoy the clarity. Giuffre was an interesting player. There's some Eddie Daniels,
mm-hmm.
wonderful, wonderful player. I enjoy that sound, especially the clarinet seems to work even the best with the guitar. There's a The overtones are a little different.
It's clean. It's different than playing with a sax.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, there's a range accommodation that's there. Like when I was learning to read, one of the things I read out of was clarinet books because the range was similar, and where they intersect is nice. Sometimes a sax can get a little woofy down below with a guitar. It just sounds kind of odd. But the clarinet is a real flute's too high. Sax can be too low. Clarinet's the right mix in there.
Just as you mentioned that, what struck me is if you played out of actual clarinet books, the lowest note on a clarinet is E.
Yeah.
And isn't it ironic that you, on a guitar player with E as your lowest string,
right,
would gravitate to a reed instrument which has as its lowest note E?
Well, what you want to do, I played out of clarinet and flute books. The older guys would say, play
sure.
out of clarinet and flute books because then you're going to have to deal with the ledger lines. You're going to have to learn how
sure.
to read that high, fast stuff, which, that's the most challenging thing for a guitar player. If it's high,
everybody.
But if it's high and it's quick, then you really got to dig in. You really got to be paying attention. Well, guitar books don't generally have a lot of that. They do now, but they didn't back then.
Mm.
So you had to go out of it. You had to get the Arban book for trumpet. You had to get all these other books, read in other instruments. And then, of course, you were a whole step high, you know, but that was like...
Oh, yeah, but then for practice...
Yeah, if you're practicing by yourself, it doesn't matter. When you want to go play duets with somebody, then somebody's got to think, you know?
Yeah, probably you played out of what is called the Carl Behrman, B-E...
B-E-H-R?
Yeah, B-H-R-M-A-N-N.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Behrman was one of the go-to books that we all had to practice.
I had a book, I had a neighbor who was a guy from France, a guitar player, and he had brought over this clarinet book that was some French book, and I had never heard of it. Nobody I knew had ever heard of it. Apparently, it was if you were a clarinetist in France, this is what you learned out of. And then he had to go back suddenly overseas, and he was called away. And he left the book, among other things, with me. So wow. I had this French clarinet book, which had exercises, you know, none of it was in English. I speak a little French, but not that much. But it didn't matter. The music was there. And mm-hmm. There was a big, thick book. It was, you know, a couple hundred pages. And that kept me busy for years.
Closé? So
I don't know. It's at my office somewhere.
Closé with a K.
Could be.
Is a very popular.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, even on saxophone, I tend to practice flute books for exactly the same reason. Mm-hmm. Because today, modern saxophone players play into an extended range above the supposedly highest note of the horn.
Yeah.
And unless you encounter that stuff, then when you run into it in an arrangement, you can be buffaloed by something because there's four ledger lines there and you're not used to ever seeing that.
Well, writers expect to be able to play those notes even though they're off the horn, but everybody plays them. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to play them if you're confronted with them.
Exactly.
But they're not. And I remember when I was a kid first learning guitar in the early mid-60s, my best friend was learning the saxophone as well. And I remember what he was playing in those days was nowhere near the range that saxophonists have now. And I remember him working on a book that had harmonics for saxophone, Sigurd Rashard.
Name? Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he was getting these like odd sounds, you know, the dogs were running away and that kind of stuff. But now, you know, after David Sanborn, I mean, everybody is playing a lot of real high stuff on the sax that nobody played 30 years ago.
Eddie Harris.
Yeah, I think David Sanborn would probably be better known.
Eddie predates him.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
But
now everybody's playing that stuff, and that's just you're just considered you have to do that, you know?
Absolutely. In fact, you you search for mouthpieces that allow you to find to get those notes with consistency. Predictability is very important.
Right. So you said something intriguing to me about 2 months ago that actually got me thinking a lot.
Hmm.
You said to me regarding teaching, you said we shouldn't be teaching 2-5-1 or words to that effect. Mm-hmm. 2-5-1 is over. We need to not teach that anymore. We need to move on. Miles obliterated that.
Mm-hmm.
And words to this effect. So let's start there.
Miles, it isn't that Miles obliterated it. It's that actually, if you know, now I'm going to put on my history hat for a moment. All of this really begins with Lester Young, who was inspired by Bix Beiderbecke and Frankie Trombauer in the late 20s. But Prez learned how to play key centers as opposed to changes.
Mm-hmm.
He would target significant changes that he felt he wanted to bring out, which would usually be the five chord. And at the time, it was fashionable. The whole tone scale was all in vogue. And that's really, for us as jazz musicians, that's really a kind of altered dominant chord.
Yeah.
And so he would be playing some tune based on I Got Rhythm. Well, okay. He'd play the first 16 bars, and basically he would just work out some melodic idea that he thought was pretty cool, and it took 16 bars to do. Then he'd hit the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the bridge to I Got Rhythm, you run into, the very first chord you run into is an altered chord in relation to the key.
Right.
And very often, Prez would ram that whole tone lick down on top of that, what we would call a three chord.
Mm-hmm, the D7.
Yeah, in the key of B flat,
right.
Yes. And that would shake people up because, first of all, that's even more altered than the chord's supposed to be, you know. And so Prez was doing that and this playing this key center. What Miles's modal jazz of the late 50s leading up to kind of blue and then from that point on is all essentially about modal jazz is essentially finding a scale that covers a whole bunch of chords.
Right.
And what's fascinating to me about probably the definitive Miles album of all time, which is kind of blue, is that you get someone like Bill Evans playing the changes behind Miles. Miles doesn't know if Bill's going to be, he's going to be playing all kinds of chords that have nothing to do with D minor other than the fact that they're out of the same scale.
Right.
And
most of the time.
Well, yeah. And even if they aren't, the ones that aren't can be heard as half step up, half step down, or chromatically altered. And you never lose track of the key. And that spawns, I think, essentially the birth of 21st century jazz begins with things like the Kind of Blue album, and then the other significant album, Shape of Jazz, to come with Ornette, because Ornette says, well, why do I have to worry about chord progressions? I can make them up as I go.
Right.
And everybody else, since I'm the soloist, everybody else has to follow me anyway.
Well, plus he wasn't playing on tunes. He wasn't playing on tunes that people knew.
Mm-hmm.
He was making stuff up, literally as he went along in some cases, or presenting a sketch and saying, this is what we're going to play on. It wasn't like he was playing rhythm changes.
Right, he was saying, this is a point of departure.
Yeah.
I'll see you in 20 minutes.
Yeah, so he liberated it for the whole thing in the way that Coltrane did, too. We're saying, okay, we're going to play this one tune because we know it's the tune, but by the middle of it, you couldn't tell if it was the same tune or not.
Exactly.
Excuse me. So then what happens? Why does that liberate us from needing to know about 2-5?
It's not that it liberates us from needing to know, but what it says is that by the end of the 20th century, we have created, there are what we call neoclassic jazz musicians. This is what Wynton Marsalis and company, the young lions.
Right, the guys who put on suits and started playing in a very structured manner. Yeah.
Yeah, the 80s guys, right, who were, in a sense, looking backwards for inspiration rather than looking at the world in which they live or looking to the future.
Yeah. I have a theory about that. I think they just didn't like rock and roll. No, seriously. And they didn't like the rock and the hip hop influence that was starting to sort of get into popular music and jazz. And they said, well, how can we play something that we know as jazz and have it totally unconfused with anything else that's going on? Well, we can put on suits and we can play these structures that people played 30 years ago, and then they become neocons, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've also heard another term gets thrown around every once in a while, retro, retro jazz.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. That kind of thing has always existed. Did you know in the middle of the bebop era, there was a traditional jazz revival started by Louis Armstrong and the All-Stars?
That would have been when I was a kid, probably.
Oh, yeah. 40s.
Oh, 40s. Okay, before I was even born.
Yeah, no.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, when Louis brings out his first all-star band, he's essentially gone back to the mid-20s. He's gone back 20 years.
But Louis wasn't really playing bebop in the way that Dizzy was and those guys. I mean,
nothing said that he had to. What I'm saying is that as a result of what he started in the mid-40s with things like the All-Star Band, that results into things like the Sacramento Jazz Jubilee, which for many, many years was just 14 or 15 traditional jazz bands playing music that was so old that they actually had people walking around with sport coats on and little, and always cracked me up. It was a Jewish star. It was a gold sewed on 6-pointed star, and it says Jazz Police.
Jazz Police.
And these guys would walk up to you, and if you were playing some awfully modern licks back there, you better think about that. You know, and it's like, what?
Yeah.
But, you know, I used to say when I would play that music, I would have to do some kind of intellectual lobotomy. I'd have to say, no altered ninth chords, no sharp fives, no chromatic approaches, no half step up or down.
Well, if you're playing a clarinet, you're actually not even supposed to play the melody. You're supposed to play obligatos, and the trumpet player is supposed to play clarinets. Supposed to play a melody anyway.
There's
rules. There's definitely rules.
Yeah, but that's all where we are, even now. It's musicians here in the beginning of the 21st century those they're being brought up and trained essentially to play 50-year-old music.
Right.
And I think this is absurd.
Well, so but I tend to agree with you in some ways, but in terms of teaching this, I mean, there's a lot of things I want to get into here that are all sort of coming down to this idea of, can you teach jazz anyway? I mean, we know you can teach the technique. We know you can teach interpretation. We can teach that kind of stuff. You can't, as with any other kind of music, you can't teach talent. You mm-hmm. can't teach inspiration. Mm-hmm. You can show people how to recognize it when they see it, when they feel it. But how do you teach jazz anyway? What's even the point? Not from a practical standpoint. We'll talk about where the gigs are going to be in 20 years in a minute.
Yeah.
But but just from the idea of teaching jazz, what does that mean to you even? What's your philosophy of that?
Well, for a long time, I ascribed to the philosophy that there was a body of knowledge that had to be assimilated by all players.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, I was, I don't know, I think in front of a class, and I want you to hear this because this really kind of cracked me up. And I was looking at them and I said, you know, your solos are the sum total of everything you practice. So be careful about what you practice.
Yeah.
If you wind up doing nothing but practicing John Coltrane licks, well, surprise. If all you do is play Charlie Parker licks, hello.
Yeah, you're going to sound like Bird.
Yeah, and the point is, if we go into an academic environment where we formalize the way we teach so that everyone learns to play giant steps in 12 keys,
right.
and everybody learns a certain body of Parker licks, a certain number of Michael Brecker licks. I'm talking saxophone now, but we could say guitar or anything. Instrument.
Anything, sure, yeah.
The what you do is you're glorifying sameness,
mm-hmm.
and sameness is boring.
But can't you do two things at once? Can't you say these are the shoulders that we're standing on? This is Bird, and this is Train, and this is Michael Brecker, and this is whoever you want it to be. This is something we have to come from. It doesn't mean that this is where we stay. It just means that this is something we acknowledge, and then we move on from there. I wonder how you teach it without doing that, I guess.
Well, I'm not saying you don't.
Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is that when you have a crystallized curriculum
mm-hmm.
where you could literally go to probably any of the top music schools in the world and you will find if there's a jazz department, they're going to be teaching certain things.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it makes more sense... I'm more interested in what we call critical thinking.
Yeah.
That to teach a student how to think, not what to think. If you teach a kid, if you somehow showed him or her that many jazz musicians would learn to play a song that they really love. Let's say the song is Cherokee. They would learn to play it in 12 keys.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason partially is because for me as a saxophone player, if I'm playing E flat alto saxophone, I'm playing Cherokee in one key.
Right.
If I'm playing B flat tenor saxophone, I'm playing in another. If I'm playing C flute, I'm playing in another. If I play alto flute, I'm playing in another. And then if I'm playing with a singer who can't do it in the standard key, I've got to play it again.
Right.
So therefore, perhaps the logic is, you really don't think you know Cherokee or whatever until it doesn't matter what key you can play it in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is saying find the songs that you love, find the licks by the players that you love, and learn to play them with facility so that you're not consciously thinking about what finger goes where
right.
in all the keys that you're going to encounter.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing.
That's technique.
But if you say everybody must learn song X in 12 keys or you get an F,
mm-hmm.
that's not dealing with encouraging critical thinking
right.
or encouraging students to be to create their own musical world.
Does anyone still teach like that, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, virtually all the music schools have a required tune list. Okay. how many tunes that are post 1990 do you think are on that list? And I can't answer that question.
Yeah. Not very many, I would think.
Exactly.
Well, this is a problem. I was discussing with a student of mine earlier today how boring it is to listen to the local jazz station here in LA because they are so hidebound in what they play. And it just, you won't hear anything that's happening now. You won't hear, there's just a lot of stuff you won't hear without going into, you know, person by person and tune by tune. And you're really not getting, it becomes like jazz background music after a while. You're not going to hear anything that's going to challenge you. You're not going to hear anything that you couldn't listen to while you're, you know, chopping onions. You know, nothing will distract you. It's, to me, that's not the best use of the public airways. It's what they've chosen to do for whatever reason. But no one's going to get challenged by anything that they're listening to there. And you're not really going to get any kind of education. Not that their facility should be, not that their first job is to educate.
No, that's to make money.
It's a public radio station, so they're not.
Oh,
gonna,
well, okay.
Not to lose too much money is what they're trying to do.
Oh, that's better. Okay.
But it's just boring. You know,
well,
it's just really boring.
I thought about that. You know, when you told me that, or when you asked me to come on this show.
I did not tell you to come on the show.
I know. But, you know, I immediately went back and started looking for materials that would make me sound reasonably intelligent. I'm not sure how
so
we're
far
doing.
You're doing fine.
I might think, okay,
yeah, you're doing great.
Well, that's good to hear. But one of the things I came up with was the whole issue of radio. And basically, there are two kinds of radio stations that are playing jazz today. Mm-hmm. One is playing the retro jazz, neoclassic jazz,
right.
And the other is smooth. And there's a whole group of music critics who are very elitist, who anything having to do smooth jazz for them is almost a dirty word.
Right.
And I look at some of the musicians. My wife and I went to see Chris Botti at the Hollywood Bowl last summer. And before he started that whole thing that we associate with Chris, first of all, Billy Child is a graduate of the USC School of Music. He's one of my students. Mm-hmm. I am so thrilled to be able to say that Billy Child was somebody that I somehow influenced.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's Billy and Chris and a rhythm section, and they come out there, and for about 10 minutes, it's almost like, what am I listening to? It is the most contemporary sounding acoustic jazz that I have heard literally in years.
Mm-hmm.
And then here comes the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, and we're doing the Chris Botti,
right.
Sting type of music.
Yeah. And which is what most people came to hear Chris Botti do.
Exactly. Yeah. But somehow I think he knew that people like me were in the audience, and
yeah.
he wanted to just say, by the way.
Well, I think he has something to prove a little bit. I think that he knows what people think of him, and I think that he's, I think that it makes him feel like, okay, I want to show people I can play. I can really play. Most of the audience doesn't care. Most of the audience, in fact, that's why he puts it at the beginning of the show instead of in the middle.
Oh, of course.
Because at the beginning, people are still out and they're filtering in and all that. You know. So.
But the whole issue is that maybe we have not found the right way to get into the groove-based music, which is so very much a part of the smooth jazz world.
Yeah.
And find a way to express something very personal and very wonderful using that kind of repertoire. And the problem for us is the 2/5 world, which is the world of the Great American Songbook,
right.
that has essentially come to an end. The only people who continually keep that going are the mostly vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
Vocalists seem to come in two flavors.
Right.
You have those who want to recreate the Great American Songbook, and then you have those who are performing much more contemporary sounding music.
But most of those, the new stuff is based on ostinatos and based on grooves more than it's based on 2/5 progressions, I think.
That's why,
yeah.
I'm saying that the most important thing to learn in terms of mastering your instrument in terms of the tradition is you need, since today most people combine twos and fives and they essentially play the five.
Right.
To develop a vocabulary of things that you think are hip and interesting for you in utilizing the five and various alterations of the five, the tritone, subs, the up and down, half steps, all of those
mm-hmm.
things. You work those things out. You listen to the players who inspire you. When you hear something that you really like, learn it in 12 keys because you liked it, not because some teacher said you have to do this to get a grade. And you take that and that synthesis of that vocabulary that is uniquely yours, not mass-produced for everyone,
mm-hmm.
will give you a particular language that you can then use to create the music that has meaning for you. And if that happens, you're probably going to survive. Look, let me tell you an interesting fact. Because of the internet, do you know how many people you actually have to be able to have, let's say in Facebook terms, like you in order for you to survive as a professional musician, jazz musician? Do you have any idea?
Is there a number?
Roughly?
Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah, 20,000.
Hmm.
Now, in a world of how many people?
Yeah.
20,000. Okay, what does that mean? It means that if 20,000 people really genuinely like your music, I don't care where they are on the planet.
Well, it doesn't matter anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, now if there's 20,000 people that want, you know, what does that mean? A typical CD, and you can still buy CDs on Amazon and things like that.
Yeah.
It's around $15. $15 times 20,000, $300,000. Now, if you're not giving that money to a record company, which most of our the young generation of jazz artists are not signed up with record companies.
Right, that's all been disintermediated.
Exactly. Yeah. Nice word.
Oh, it's a good
word. Geez, that's a 50-cent word.
I'm a geek.
Oh, I like it. So anyway, if you take that and you say, okay, if you can produce a product that you can be proud of and you can disseminate it through the internet and through going out and doing everything from church picnics to your local pop, jazz, reggae, smooth festival in whatever town you live in.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that at least once or twice a year, you're gonna do better than the the national average for to be defined as actually poor is 23,005.
Yeah, well, everybody is happy with the new system, and I'll tell you why. The big record labels never really wanted jazz artists anyway. I mean, since jazz stopped being popular music in the 40s and 50s, they didn't really want jazz artists. It's something they kept around because they could make money. It didn't cost them a lot because jazz artists were recording standards.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not a real big problem. And then they started writing their own tunes, and that became even better. These guys weren't used to making a lot of money. So all in all, that kind of system worked for everybody, except it didn't work for the band leaders. It was crappy for the band leaders because the record labels gave them no support. Mm-hmm. Now with the idea of disintermediation that you don't need permission. If you want to go record a CD, you no longer have to go and get someone to sign you.
Mm-hmm.
You can go, I mean, in this room, you can record an entire jazz CD without leaving this room. I've got everything here to do that with.
That's absolutely right.
And you can put it out yourself. You can do your own artwork. You can do your own marketing. The marketing is the big problem. But you can do all this stuff. The only thing you need a big major record label for is getting you on Dave Letterman. It's very hard to do that yourself. And if you want to make appearances on national media, that's hard without a record label, without a big record label. Aside from that, everybody can do their own thing now, which is a good thing. The bad news is everybody can do their own thing now. So there's a lot of crap out there, and there's also a lot of good stuff that nobody ever hears. So this is what happens with disintermediation, where the fact of the question is no longer can this product make a profit. The question is should this product exist? And it's a very different way of looking at things than it was even 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. When I was doing major rock and roll tours, we always had somebody with us from the record label as an advanced person. They were making sure the record got played. They were making sure that the artist got on the radio in whatever town we were in. They were financing the tour. The record labels financed the tours because they would get the money back and they kept the publishing. And there was a lot of ways that, you know, they did that. Now it's all different. It's a whole different thing. It's a whole different system. And it's good, but it's also, you know, not so good because there's a lot of stuff out there that won't get heard. All right, that's the end of part one. Join us on the flip side, as they used to say. Hey, join us on the flip side. Very jazzy, very Chuck Niles, very Symphony Sid. Join us on the flip side. Hey, join us on the flip side for part two with Dr. Tom Mason on Jazz Ed. See you there.